Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network. For the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews, press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, Alicia Malone with Scott Movie Mance and the Schmoes Know. This is Profiles. In-depth spotlights on the greatest filmmakers and artists in motion picture history.
Hello, Profilers.
Oh, that was loud, sorry.
Welcome to episode 27, where we spotlight David Lynch.
And your phone's ringing.
And my phone is ringing. Who could that be?
Do you need to take it?
I do not.
Okay, good.
That's okay.
We're always on standby here because sometimes we have guests call in and they might call Mance's cell phone by mistake. But we're talking today about David Lynch.
David Lynch. And this, Alicia, 27 episodes of Profiles. We always say, you know, this is a director. This is an actor and actress. Really, really different, really great. One of the most famous, the best, the most talented. But David Lynch really is in a class all by himself. There is no one like him. The closest filmmaker, the closest director I could really think of who really just did his own thing, Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, true, because David Lynch's films are completely his vision from start to finish. There's no marketing teams involved. They're definitely not commercial movies. They're not made for a wide audience. And they're very open to interpretation, very surreal.
They mean
different things to different people. I love that. I love that he lets the audience decide what they might take out of the film, and it might be completely different for me than it is for you.
And he does not chime in at all on what his movies were meant to be.
No.
And
He doesn't like to explain it.
One of our guests, the guest that we're talking to later today, actually brought up the fact that on the DVDs that he personally approved, there are no chapter breaks because he wants people to experience the movies complete. So many adjectives can be used to describe his movies. Surreal, trippy,
dreamlike,
baffling, challenging, freaky, uncompromising, scary, kind of funny,
disturbing,
unforgettable.
This David Lynch is essential viewing for film buffs, but we know that many people out there maybe haven't seen many of David Lynch's films, haven't seen any of David Lynch's films. So we will like to use this Profiles episode as an entry point for you guys. So people who might not have known about David Lynch, this is your chance to get to know the man and to watch some of these movies. So we won't spoil them, although it's pretty hard to spoil a David Lynch movie because they're so open.
Yeah, even we're not really sure what we're talking about here, but that's what it's all about. It's all about interpretation. But what I like about doing the show, and I know you agree, is the homework we get to do, not only watching the movies, but looking up things, trying to find research, trying to find things that even we didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And I know for sure that neither one of us have done as much research as we did on David Lynch, because there was so much to read about, so much to delve into with these films, because they really do mean different things to different people.
And it was quite a unique experience to see these movies in a short space of time.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had seen all the movies we're talking about, I'd seen them before, but years apart. And to see them all in a row, I do feel a bit weird, like I'm in David Lynch's world, but it was a real treat to watch them all.
Well, this is also a wonderful career, a wonderful life, a lot more interesting. A lot more to the guy than you would think. He's not just about his movies, is he?
No, he's an artist as well, and a musician, and he does so much. And we have our segment called It's a Wonderful Life, which gives you some background on his characters. So, Stephen, roll the video.
Writer, director, actor, artist, musician. David Keith Lynch was born on January 20th, 1946, in the small town of Missoula, Montana. With early ambitions to become a painter, Lynch enrolled at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 1964, and soon after that, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia. It was there that he transitioned into making short films, starting with Six Men Getting Sick Six Times in 1967 and The Alphabet in 1968. In 1971, Lynch moved to Los Angeles, where he studied at the American Film Institute, and in 1977, he released his first feature, and boy, it was a doozy. Taking 5 years to make, that film, the bizarre, surrealistic masterpiece, Eraserhead, became an instant cult classic and immediately established Lynch as a filmmaker to be reckoned with. David Lynch has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards, 3 for Best Director, and in 1990 he won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival for Wild at Heart. Lynch has 4 children and has been married to his 4th wife, Emily Stolfi, since 2009.
I was just trying to type to our live YouTube audience while I was watching that and doing other things, so I don't think it made sense. But Bill Pollan wants me to do the Profilers shimmy, so there you go.
The Profilers shimmy, of course, that gets a high five.
Oh.
And you should know the Profilers drinking game right now. Every time we do a high five, you take a shot. So by the time they get to the end of the episode, you are drunk off your butts.
It's the best way to do it. So what was your first blood when it comes to David Lynch? What was the film you saw first?
The first film I saw first, again, once again, going back to my parents, who were cutting edge, ahead of their time, taking this nice little kid to disturbing films,
yeah,
was The Elephant Man.
Wow.
11 years old, saw this movie in 1980, and I was terrified. Because the first time you see John Merrick, you know, I had never seen anything like that before. And I'll never forget when he said, I'm not an animal, I'm a human being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was a haunting thing.
Scene.
But watching that movie, this is like a scene out of a damn movie right here.
Watch out.
Watching that film really opened my eyes to human nature, both the good and the bad, especially when you realize that John Merrick was actually the sweet, nice, kind, smart person.
Yeah.
What was yours?
Mine was my favorite David Lynch film, which I'm wearing my t-shirt for, Blue Velvet.
That was your first.
That was my first. And I saw it many years after it came out, of course, because it came out in 86. And I saw it on VHS.
Not in a cinema.
It was one of my 7 films for 7 days for $7 special that I used to go and get every single week. I'll go down to the video store and just get a stack of them. And I remember hearing a lot about this film, seeing it spoofed, especially the Dennis Hopper.
Oh, man.
With the gas. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what it would be about, and I had no idea what I was in for. I didn't like it the first time I saw it.
You didn't like it? See, this is like your kind of movie.
I know. At the time, though, I thought it was too dark, too disturbing.
Too dark for Alicia Milano.
I didn't know what to make of it, but for some reason, I wanted to watch it again, even though I didn't like it.
Sure.
It got in my brain, and then I thought, I have to see it again, and I watched it a couple of years later, I think, and I liked it more. And then every time I've seen it since, I've liked it more and more. Now I've watched it so much that my iTunes movies, when I rent it, it's like, are you sure you want to rent that again?
For the 80th time?
Just rent that? I'm like, yes, iTunes, of
course. Isn't it great, though, when you can watch movies like Blue Velvet or any one of the movies on our Fast Five and get something different out of it every time you see it?
Yeah, every single time you see something different, or it means something different to you because you're in a different stage of your life. I love that.
Exactly. Definitely like what you were talking about with a movie that we'll get to later, about how it meant one thing to you when you first saw it, and it meant a lot more to you when you moved to Hollywood to pursue your dreams.
Think you can guess which movie we're talking about.
Absolutely. But coming in first on our Fast Five at number 5 is...
As a matter of fact, I'm there right now.
What do you mean, you're where?
At your house.
Oh, Lost Highway. Now, this is a movie, when I saw it on February 21st, 1997, opening night at the Sunset Five in West Hollywood, I did not like it, and I didn't like it so much, it actually put me in a bad mood, because I saw it with a buddy, and we argued about the film after the fact. He liked it, I didn't, and then I realized the fact that I was arguing with him about it meant that it stirred something inside of me. The movie cost $15 million to make, only made $3.8 million domestically, so it was kind of it was definitely a box office disappointment for David Lynch. But this was a film, there's so much to it, starting with the casting of Robert Blake as the mystery man.
Yeah, so should we give a little bit of background in case people haven't seen it?
Yes, please do.
It's kind of two intersecting stories, or is it one story? that's up to interpretation. It's about a jazz musician played by Bill Pullman who Worries that his wife is having an affair. He gets framed for his murder, put in prison, and then it
changes.
He becomes
a different person.
He morphs into a young mechanic.
Yeah,
played by Balthazar Getty, and gets drawn into the world of this this gangster world where the gangster mole, beautiful girl, is played by Patricia Arquette. So she plays both the wife and the gangster's mole, and then it switches more at the end. And then you've got the mystery man played by Robert Blake. I'm doing a terrible job explaining it.
But you know what? You're actually doing a great job explaining it because you're right on the money. And this is where it gets interesting, because this is a film that is sort of the beginning of two trilogies for David Lynch. One was like they called this the Hollywood trilogy that started with Lost Highway, definitely peaked with Mulholland Drive, and fizzled out with Inland Empire. But it's also the Identity Crisis trilogy.
It's all about fractured identities.
Fractured identities. This is a neo-noir occult psychodrama. And how's that for a genre?
Okay.
There's so much dualism, so much illusion, so much mystery in this film, because like another film that we're going to be talking about on today's show, this is a film where the identity of the person changes because they can't come to terms with what they did. Mm-hmm. And it's not even clear about what Bill Pullman's character might have done.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say too much beyond that because I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I do love that every one of the films on our list today are movies that you got to see more than once, you got to see it more than twice, and please tweet us at Alicia Malone and at Movie Mance. Let us know what you think of these David Lynch movies too.
I like the neo-noir style, and that's something that David Lynch does so well, because film noir is my favorite film genre, and a lot of his films, including Lost Highway, has that 50s style feel, even though they're set in modern times.
Right.
This point was the 90s. It has a femme fatale, it's got desperate men. It's almost sci-fi at times, and this came after the Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the film adaptation from the TV show, which didn't go so well. The movie, it wasn't as popular as the TV show. So then David Lynch came up with this concept, and this is exactly what he wanted to do. So you get the real sense that this is completely him. It's totally his imagination.
His vision.
And it's divisive. Some people like it, say that it's one of his best movies. Some people don't like it, and a lot of people haven't seen it.
A lot of people haven't seen it.
It also has that sense of deja vu about it, doesn't it? When I was watching it again, I got a real sense of deja vu in terms of the characters being played by either the same actor or the same character being played by different actors, and then the recording, and there's several moments that are repeated in the movie. It just, to me, the whole thing conjures up a sense of deja vu.
That's interesting.
Like people feel like they've been there before or done it before, and it kind of circles back around at the end. I love the fact that you can really delve into these movies.
Well, one thing that, exactly, I mean, that's what's so great about it.
So great.
I mean, this could be like
and
a three-hour episode of Profiles just because of us talking about what we think are really happening. And one of the subconscious influences that David Lynch had for Lost Highway, when you see the film, you'll know why he was inspired by the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
And the irony, and I think I might spoil something here, but we're going to have to do that. That Robert Blake, this is the last movie he did before he went through the whole trial that he killed his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie deals with a similar theme.
Yeah, it does.
And the casting, Richard Pryor is in this movie.
I forgot that he was in this movie. Marilyn Manson,
that's
right.
He's
in the movie
too. Right. Yeah.
It's so interesting, the casting. And like all of David Lynch's films, he often explores a dark underbelly underneath something that seems perfect.
That is very Lynchian.
That's very Lynchian.
Very Lynchian, yes. He gets his own adjective. Now, this movie, like you said, people love it, people hate it. You know who hated it?
Hey.
Siskel and Ebert.
That's right. They
gave it two thumbs down.
Yeah.
And David Lynch said, there's a gimmick. So he used the two thumbs down on the newspaper ads for Lost Highway.
That's cool.
As if to get more people into the film. But it's just very interesting. Like, what do you think the mystery man, what do you think of Robert Blake's character? I think he's the devil.
Yeah.
Because he sees images of the mystery man before he actually meets him at that party, which, by the way, is one of the craziest scenes that scene at the party.
Which you heard a little bit of before.
And he says, call me, I'm at your house.
I'm at your house right now.
I'm at call your house me. Right now. He calls and says, give me back my phone.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Head explosion. I don't know. I always thought it was his subconscious.
Interesting.
Like
okay.
The darker side of him or something that he was dealing with inside.
Interesting. Okay. But why does he become Baltazar Getty? What's your take on why?
I think that's the idealized version of him.
Right. Right.
What this he was wants to be.
Okay, so here Bill Pullman's character is married to Patricia Arquette,
yes.
who plays Renee.
Mm-hmm.
And their relationship is got troubles. He thinks
he's
that she's
paranoid.
Having an affair.
Yeah.
Like the sex isn't great. So then he reverts to Baltazar Getty, Pete Dayton, who has a crush on his mob boss friend's wife,
yep.
played by a blonde version of Patricia Arquette, and they have great sex.
Yeah.
And Baltazar Getty's character is having sex with other women too. So
she says, you'll never have me.
You'll never have, but the way she said it
yeah.
was so ominous.
So
boy,
good.
What a great character, right?
Yeah, great character, a great film, but apparently Schmoville didn't like, or our profilers didn't like Lost Highway because we got no comments.
No
about
comments
it.
From Lost Highway. So now is your chance. If you're watching Profiles Live, make sure you go shoot us a message right now. Let us know what you think. And of course, there's always Facebook. Let us know on Facebook. Tweet us at Alicia Malone at
yes.
Movie Mance. Let us know. I guess that means we just move on.
Well, GamerX76, who's watching right now on YouTube, says the first 40 minutes of this film and the way it uses shadows and dark rooms is some of the scariest fit scenes I've ever seen, which I very much true. And Cole Boone says simply, David Lynch is a master of the mind. Beep.
Definitely.
Definitely. All right. So going into our right stuff. What is your favorite scene?
Well, the scene that we just talked about with Robert Blake was definitely up there. But I'm going to go on my right stuff. I'm going with Mulholland Drive
mm-hmm.
at Club Silencio.
Silencio.
When Rebecca Del Rio comes out and sings a Spanish version of Crying. It is so symbolic of what the Betty/Diane character is feeling in her subconscious, but her delivery of the song is so impassioned that as Betty and Rita are embracing each other and holding each other, I just got swept with so much emotion during that scene because it was so powerful. Another great scene in Mulholland Drive is Betty's audition, which she nailed.
Oh, yeah. She's so good.
She was so good. You're like, but you know, you're watching this movie for the first time in 2001 going, Naomi Watts, who is that?
Yeah.
Breakthrough.
In Australia, we're like, oh, finally.
Oh, yeah, finally. She's making it big. Yeah.
She's been in LA for so long before she got that role.
What's yours?
Well, I was going to go with, in Blue Velvet, the Roy Orbison in Dreams miming scene, because that's so haunting and powerful as well. He uses music so well. But I'm going to go with Mulholland Drive. It's a scene that we were talking about before the show started, which is the scene in the diner. When Dan tells his friend about the nightmare he's had, and then things start to happen exactly the way he's telling them.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it's such a haunting scene. It's scary. And the way it builds in anticipation, and you feel a sense of dread. And then when things go exactly the way he describes them, and there's the big shock at the end, it's really gets your heart going, and it's terrifying. And it's the first kind of, I guess, supernatural or weird moment in the film, because up to that point, it seems fairly straightforward.
It seems fairly straightforward until you get to that point.
Weird, but it doesn't seem as strange as that scene.
And as for what that scene means, we'll get to that.
We will get to
that. I would say we'll get to that. But because there is so much to David Lynch's movies, there is a lot of trivia in our last detail. Specifically, did you know, Alicia, you probably did, this is kind of been out there, but I forgot about it, that David Lynch was offered the chance.
That's what I was going to say.
To direct
Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi, of course.
I wrote that down too.
Of course you did.
So George Lucas saw The Elephant Man.
Right.
And offered him to direct Return of the Jedi, but then David Lynch was worried that he would ruin George Lucas's vision.
Yeah, he thought it was more Lucas's sensibility than his.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
No, I can't.
Can you imagine?
No, because David Lynch is such an interesting filmmaker, I can't imagine what goes on in his mind.
Although, when you're watching Return of the Jedi, Admiral Akbar, you know, who's like, it's a trap, doesn't he look like the baby from Eraserhead?
Oh, yeah. was a bit. That's sperm-like
just,
baby.
Yeah, that's sperm-like baby. Weird. We'll talk about that too.
Yeah, well, did you know about Eraserhead that Stanley Kubrick loved the movie? And so much so that when he was starting production on The Shining, he got his cast and crew to all sit down and watch Eraserhead because it evoked the kind of atmosphere that he wanted to create in The Shining.
Which was just total fear, dread.
Anxiety.
Anxiety. Yeah, watching Eraserhead again.
Relationships.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
There's a lot to Eraserhead, isn't there? A
lot to it.
A lot to that movie.
Okay, do you have another one?
Did you know that some of David Lynch's influences that he's publicly cited, obviously Stanley Kubrick, Fellini, mm-hmm. Polanski, mm-hmm. Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
No wonder.
Well, when I was growing up, I always assumed that David Lynch was European.
Oh, yeah.
Because his movies feel more like that style, that surreal style, rather than American movies to me at the time. And then I realized he was American. I was like, oh, wow.
Yep, spent some time in Philadelphia.
That's right.
Where he did not have a good experience, which is why he made Eraserhead. I mean, Philadelphia was bad back in the day. It wasn't that bad. But yeah. We're going to take a moment right now to just take care of some very, very important business. Obviously, you know, we love doing profiles.
Yes.
We know you love watching and listening to profiles.
Hopefully.
We want to keep doing this.
Yes, we do.
We want to keep doing this. We know you want to keep watching and listening. So please do us a huge, huge favor. Share profiles with everyone you know. Go to our Facebook page. Yes, we're going to harass you to share profiles with everyone you know. Go to our Facebook page, which is Profiles with Malone and Mance. Like our Facebook page and then share it with all of your friends and then have them share it with their friends too. This way, you'll be the first to know who our next profile is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You can join in on the fun when we ask you what you thought of all the movies we're going to be talking
about.
We're
going to do some Q&As there soon. So you can ask us any questions you like.
Oh, that's going to be fun. We're going to start doing that next week.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yes, let's do it. High five. Awesome.
Ow!
And then make sure, also very, very important, go to iTunes and make sure you subscribe to Profiles and rate and review us on iTunes. We actually really need these ratings and reviews and subscriptions to survive. That's really where we're going to make our mark and show on the charts of iTunes. So please make sure you subscribe, rate, yes, and review us on iTunes. Make sure you follow Alicia Malone on Twitter at Alicia Malone. Follow me on Twitter at Movie Mance. Alicia Malone, Movie Mance, at Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance.
What was that again?
What was that? At Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance, and also on YouTube.
Yeah, on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork, and you can watch us normally Tuesdays, 3 p.m. LA time. Today we're doing it differently because I was in Austin for South by Southwest, so I only got back last night. And make sure if you're watching this video, give us a little thumbs up.
We
love to see the thumbs up, not the thumbs down. And give us a comment because we try to reply to all of them.
Yes, we're very, very, very interactive with our profilers.
Because we love you guys.
We love you guys. And we also love number 4 on our Fast Five,
which is...
I am not an animal!
I am a human being. Yes, the Elephant Man, released October 10th, 1980. Cost $5 million. Box office $26 million. 8 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director for David Lynch, Best Adapted Screenplay, which he co-wrote, Best Actor, William Hurt. I know that we talked about this. This is one of David Lynch's most commercial movies.
Most straightforward.
And his most straightforward.
So I say, if you want to get into David Lynch, this is a good place to start.
Yep.
Because it'll ease you into the craziness of David Lynch. It's got the surreal bookends, but for what it is, it's a pretty standard film in his terms.
But he does
add a lot to it. He takes what could have been kind of a boring story or just a standard biopic and he makes it something more, something stylish. I love the fact that it came out in 1980, but a lot of people, including myself, often forget that it came out then because it feels like it came out a long time ago. It's set during Victorian ages, basically a story, as you were saying, about John Merrick, disfigured guy, and in Victorian London, and it really shows the ugliness of society. And with the period setting plus the black and white,
yep,
it often feels a lot older than it is, if that makes sense.
It feels older than it is, but at the same time, it feels timeless.
Oh, yeah.
Like this movie could have come out today,
mm-hmm,
and it would have looked and felt just as relevant now as it did in 1980,
exactly,
or even if it came back in 1940. That's the beauty of it. And this was David Lynch's first studio film. It was released by Paramount. And
it's interesting how it came about, right? Because
Mel Brooks, executive produced this movie. I totally forgot that.
Me too. I actually didn't know that till I started doing research. So Mel Brooks had a private screening of Eraserhead, and then he knew he'd found a director for his next project. But he took his name off as producer because
Why?
He didn't want people going in there thinking it was a Mel Brooks comedy.
Right. And this is nothing. This
not
is
a
absolutely
comedy.
Not. I mean, if it was going to be a Mel Brooks comedy, it would have had Marty Feldman as the Elephant Man.
It's actually really sad.
It is sad.
The way he's treated, an animal. Not like a human.
But it is sad. It's beautiful. It's moving. It's absorbing and a really poignant film. Because who is to say that John Merrick is too ugly to bear or too beautiful to bear? I mean, he's a beautiful, lovely person. Like when he is really just brought into like a more civilized world. And there's that great scene with Anne Bancroft when they're talking about plays. And they're quoting
Romeo and Juliet.
She calls him Romeo. Did your heart just not break?
Yeah.
She calls him Romeo.
It's the first person that really, one of the first people that shows him real compassion.
Yes. And Anthony Hopkins as Frederick Treves is fantastic in this movie. This is a story about friendship. Great cinematography by Freddie Francis. Great makeup by Wally Schneiderman. It took John Hurt 8 hours a day to get made up, and it took him 2 hours to take off the makeup.
And it prompted the Academy to create the best makeup and hair
category
for future, because they did such a good job and people felt like they missed out. John Hurt, I mean, such an achievement to be able to act under all that makeup and have it touch you, his performance completely touch your soul. And it does. I mean, it actually made me quite sad watching it again.
And, you know, he couldn't sleep on his back because his head was so heavy that he wouldn't be able to breathe.
It's that train station scene gets me every time. And when people are coming in to see him as a freak, when he gets put in a cage, I don't want to give too much away, but
it's
really sad. But again, David Lynch shows the darkness underneath this perfect Victorian society.
What's your take on the beginning of the movie where it shows the dream that the mother is having with the elephant? What's your take of the symbol? Is she actually getting raped by an elephant, and that's why she has a baby that's the Elephant Man?
I always thought it was him. That's him, his projections. Like, he felt like something's wrong with him. They called him the Elephant Man. So maybe in his mind, he thought he was broken and deformed, and that's how he came about.
Wow.
I don't know, but again, those bookends.
That's interpretation.
Open to interpretation.
Amazing.
Which is awesome.
Well, the profilers had this to say about the Elephant Man. Kyle Bailey, I always heard about David Lynch from Mel Brooks interviews, there you go, when talking about his production company, but I had never come around to watching his movies until this past year. My first blood was The Elephant Man, and I was blown away by it. So many phenomenal performances from Hurt, Hopkins, and Bancroft, and beautiful cinematography and a beautiful score, and of course, the awesome makeup.
Joshua Price on YouTube says, Hopkins is overlooked in that film. An amazing performance beside Hurt.
It's true.
I agree. Liam Logrand says,
Liam,
The Elephant Man is one of my all-time favorite films. John Hurt's portrayal of John Merrick is a career-defining performance as he transforms into arguably the most human character portrayed in a Lynch film. It's true. It's probably Lynch's most sentimental movie out of all he's done.
Absolutely is. Yep.
The relationship he has between Anthony Hopkins, Frederick, is nothing more than incredible. Seeing Treves help Merrick become a member of society was extremely satisfying as he truly becomes a person. There are countless scenes throughout the film, particularly when Merrick is cornered by a group of people, when I began to judge humanity for the way it treats outsiders and those that are considered different. By the end of it all, I was a complete mess. Whoever thought that David Lynch would make me cry five times in two hours.
Oh, Liam, he's so sensitive.
I agree. I had tears and I never cry in movies.
You know, the only other movie I can think of where that approached this level of sentimentality was The Straight Story. And that was so off the beaten path for David Lynch. We'll get to more about that. But for right now, my friend, your favorite part of Profiles is our quiz show.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to start off here.
Hit me with it.
I'm going to hit you up. In Mulholland Drive,
yes,
where does Betty say she is from? Was it A?
I'm trying to look at your card.
Was it A, Vancouver, British Columbia? Was it B, Erie, Pennsylvania? Was it C, Deep River, Ontario? Or D, Wichita, Kansas.
Deep River, Ontario.
Deep River, Ontario it is. Ding, ding, ding. Yay. Very, very good. I that gets another high five. Very nice.
Okay. Mine is, which other actress was considered for Sandy, which is Laura Dern's character in Blue Velvet?
Okay.
Was it A... Ooh, music. Turn up the tension. Okay. Was it A, Patricia Arquette? B, Molly Ringwald? C, Winona Ryder?
I'm going to go B, Molly Ringwald.
Yay!
Yes! All right!
Correct.
Very good.
Thank
I only
you.
Knew
and
that
we survived quiz show.
In the back of my mind, I remember reading the name Molly Ringwald somewhere.
That's
on
good.
My research for David Lynch.
I didn't know that till I did my research.
Very, very interesting. Well, moving on. In our Fast Five is a movie that, well, I'm just going to say it's my number one, but it's number three on our Fast Five, and it is...
This is the Girl.
This is
the
girl.
Mulholland Drive, released October 12th, 2001. And I got to tell you, this was the very first movie that I saw at a screening after 9/11.
Wow.
So the mood in this country and the world was just really, really bad at the time. And I think that frame of mind really just made me more absorbed to the dread faced in Mulholland Drive. This movie cost $15 million to make. Box office was $20 million domestic. Now, this movie was nominated for one Academy Award. One Academy Award. And what is the award that it was nominated for? Best Director. Mm-hmm. Not makeup, not editing, not score, although all those would have been perfectly cool too. But for this film to get its nomination in Best Director shows you just how much of a visionary David Lynch is, that he was the one nominated for this movie as director.
Yeah, I love this movie. I actually had so much fun rewatching it again. I've seen it quite a lot of times, but as we were talking about off camera, I see it so differently now that I live in LA.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is about broken dreams, Hollywood dreams, and it feels very much inspired by Sunset Boulevard.
Yep.
The Billy Wilder classic, which is about broken dreams in Hollywood.
It makes Sunset Boulevard look like a Disney movie.
It's true. It's true. The tagline for this movie is Love Story in the City of Dreams. And this is a movie that definitely every time you watch it, you get something new out of it. You see something you haven't seen before, or it means something to you differently. Like we were saying about Lost Highway, this is also about fractured identities, and it's about multiple role playing and about reinvention, which is all stuff that happens here in Hollywood. The basic story is...
Okay, try it.
I'm going to try it.
Here you go.
So Naomi Watts plays a young actress who comes from Betty.
Betty, okay.
She comes to Hollywood, big dreams, big hopes. She's a very cliched character.
Idealistic, thumbs up, very naive.
She goes to stay at her aunt's place and she finds a mysterious woman staying there. Can't remember her name. She's been in an accident. She sees a poster with Rita Hayworth. She says her name is Rita. Mm-hmm. Then the two try to figure out what happened to her, a detective story, and they try to put it together. And then it all changes.
It all changes because of a blue key and a blue box.
So they play multiple characters in this movie, and half the time you're not sure what's real, what's a dream, what's a fantasy, what's a fantasy version of their lives, or their real life.
And characters come and go who you really, really doesn't make any sense at all until you start to put it together. But this is a movie it's haunting. It's a haunting film. It's scary. It's intense. It's mind-boggling. It's sexy.
It is sexy.
Oh, boy, is it sexy. And it is also funny sometimes.
It is. And it's a neo-noir, again. Mm-hmm. It's got that 50s feel to it. And also in terms of film noir, like being a whodunit, mm-hmm. and having some femme fatales in there.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's, again, like I mentioned, this is my personal favorite of all David Lynch's movies. In fact, back in 2010, I did my top 10 best movies of the O's, mm-hmm. The first 10 years of the century. And number four on my list was Mulholland Drive. And what I said at the time, it's not about the destination. It's about the journey. And director David Lynch's moody masterpiece of film noir is much like the Los Angeles road in which it takes its name. Mm. It's breathtaking and beautiful with lots of twists and turns, but where it goes, nobody knows.
Oh, I like that, because I also get scared I'm going to fall off the edge when I'm driving a Mulholland Drive, because it is very windy.
Very windy.
At the edge of cliff sometimes.
You gotta be careful.
You gotta be careful. And again, this shows the darkness underneath the Hollywood fairy tale.
Let's talk about how dark this movie is. If you want to come to LA and pursue your dreams in Hollywood, don't watch Mulholland Drive.
I mean, I'm still here.
Your dreams are already happening.
I still came to Hollywood after seeing this movie.
You're a success story. You are a success story. But this movie has a very challenging structure. Now, basically, if you've never seen Mulholland Drive, what you need to know is this. Watch the last 30 minutes of the movie first.
Oh, really?
That is the reality.
Yes.
What happens in the previous hour and 50 minutes is all fantasy.
Yeah, I liked the surprise of the end when I first saw it, but I think that is a good way to do it.
Because...
just to understand the structure a bit better.
You're watching the first part of the movie, the first two-thirds of the film, and Betty, played by Naomi Watts, and Rita, played by Laura Herring, Laura Herring's character is a figmentation of Camilla. Camilla is the real actress that Diane, who was the real character played by Naomi Watts, they had a relationship.
Lovers.
It didn't work out. And Diane, Naomi Watts, can't get over Camilla, played by Laura Herring. So she decides that she's going to take her out. She hires a hitman.
Mm-hmm.
And
don't give away too much.
Don't want to give away too much. But the fantasy that you see in the first hour, 50 minutes, is the life that Diane wanted to have. So she has identified herself as Betty, and she comes to L.A. with dreams of making it in Hollywood after winning a sort of polka, a jitterbug contest.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and she's just so naive and idealistic. And it's interesting to point out that both Mulholland Drive and Blue Velvet both deal with naive and idealistic characters, and they get swept up in this in this mystery, and I'm totally distracted here.
Should we try to? So there's someone calling in.
I think someone's calling in. It could be our special guest.
We'll give it a go.
Steve, who do we have on the phone?
Caller, you on the line?
Hello there.
Hello.
I don't know. Sorry, guys.
Okay. Nope, well, thank you, Steve.
No one's here. False alarm.
Well, getting back to Mulholland Drive, again, the characters played by Naomi Watts and Kyle MacLachlan are both drawn into this mystery that they kind of get off on the mystery until it uncovers this underbelly of darkness. And it's just unlike anything they ever experienced.
Yeah, and unlike anything you'll see on the screen either.
Well, the other thing about the score of this movie by Angelo Badalamenti, who also did Lost Highway and Blue Velvet. He plays one of the mysterious men in the casting session where Justin Theroux's character is told this is the girl.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the composer of this movie. And Roger Ebert, his review, he said that this movie works because David Lynch is absolutely uncompromising.
Mm-hmm.
Well, earlier today, we had a great interview for Profiles with Justin Theroux, who played Adam Kirscher in Mulholland Drive. We're going to roll that interview right now. It was great to have him on the show.
Yes.
Really great interview. Let's hear it.
Take it away.
Hi there.
Hey, it's Justin.
Hey, Justin. It's Scott and Alicia.
On?
How are you, man?
I'm good.
Thank you so much for calling into Profiles. Our topic, our spotlight this week is David Lynch, and you are talking with Alicia Malone and Scott Nance. Thank you so much for joining us on Profiles.
Pleasure.
It has been such a treat for us to rewatch all David Lynch's movies back to back. I kind of feel like I'm in some kind of surreal dream at the moment.
I'll bet.
I feel like I'm not quite real. So, in your opinion, what makes David Lynch such a brilliant filmmaker, and why is he in his league all on his own, in a league all on his own?
I don't know. I think there's a bunch of ways to answer that. I think, you know, one, I don't think he remains pretty steadfastly unplugged as far as sort of what's going on in film or whatever, and really doesn't pay much attention to sort of the industry or goes without saying, you know, like other kind of more pop culture films. He's a lover of old film, of course, but I think he's really good at kind of just getting his, you know, whatever his sort of subconscious ideas are about filmmaking, transferred from whatever he's thinking to a script to the screen. And he's very adept at kind of staying true to his vision, which I know sounds like it might be easy, but I think for anyone trying to make a film, especially, you know, films cost a lot of money to make,
yeah.
It's difficult to do. And he also, I don't think, puts any pressure on himself as far as having to make a film a year or do any of the kind of things that, you know, he doesn't put himself on the same treadmill that I think a lot of filmmakers do.
Well, what was your first impression of him, and how did you even meet him in the first place?
A plane, is that right?
What's that?
Was that right that you were on a plane, I was reading?
No, my first impression was when I saw, I was about 14, I saw one of his films. I saw my first film that I watched of his, I think, was Blue Velvet.
Yes.
And it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I remember buying a ticket to it. I remember the poster of it sort of, you know, had, you know, Rossellini sort of, you know, draped with Kyle MacLachlan or something. And I remember thinking, like, oh, this will probably be like Dirty Dancing or something. and I went into the movie theater and came out a couple hours later, changed tween, you know. But first meeting him, I had been put on tape, you know, Mulholland Drive, one of the movies I did with him was originally an ABC pilot. And I was told they were putting people on tape for him. And I went in, and there was no sides or audition or anything like that. It was just kind of a sit-down with a casting director who asked you a series of questions. Just, and I can't remember really what they were. It was kind of like, you know, what are you reading? What do you like? You know, and you just answered them. And then I guess all these tapes sort of went to him, and he just watched them. And then I got a call, basically just months and months later. I thought I'd long forgotten about it, saying, David would like to meet you. Can you come to Los Angeles? And I thought, I was in New York at the time, I thought, sure. I flew out to Los Angeles that day and went right from the airport to meet him and met him on the stoop of his house. And he was just so lovely. I mean, it was not what you would... I had no picture in my head of what David looked like. and, you know, you sort of think it's going to be, you know, Marty Feldman with, you know, lightning bolts cracking over his house. But it wasn't. He was just the sweetest, most... kind man, you know, these deep, deep blue eyes.
Well, what was your first impression when you read the script for Mulholland Drive?
Then I think I had to read the script in his office, and I read it, and, you know, like anyone, I didn't know, I had no clue what was going on in the script. You know, I mean, it was compelling. Every scene I remember being very compelling, and I couldn't, you know, but, and again, if he was a first-time filmmaker, I probably would have been like, I don't know what this means. but because I'd seen all of his other work at that point, you know, I was so eager to just try and jump in, you know.
Well, did you ask him, like, okay, David, like, what is going on here? Did you actually go to him and say, can you please just tell me what's going on here? And what did he say if you tried to ask?
I could answer that anecdotally. I remember the first day on set, you know, I had sort of broken down my script and sort of, you know, what I thought things meant and the way things should be played. And I remember he did a very smart thing, which, you know, we went into, normally you go into rehearse a scene and, you know, the crew's kind of standing around leaning on, you know, boom mics and stuff like that, waiting for you to hurry up. But he cleared everyone out. And kind of said, you know, like, you know, all right, let's just talk about it. And we started talking about it, and I sort of went into all those sort of boring acting questions, like, all right, so I'm saying this, but am I doing that? And what am I? But later in the movie, I'm trying to do this and that and the other. And so I guess I just need to know what I should be doing here in this scene, you know. And he has a wonderful way of just kind of looking at you and going, like, I don't know either, man. Let's just figure it out. let's discover that. You know, like, so he has a very, his approach to making a scene is very organic. You know, he doesn't really put, he's one of the greatest directors in that he kind of doesn't, you don't feel like you have much time pressure, you know, not much downward pressure, not much studio pressure, not much. He just kind of takes the pressure off and, like, lets things happen pretty organically, and he loves it when things don't go according to plan, and he gets excited by accidents, and, you know, there was a bunch of things, you know, times in making Mulholland Drive where he just would leap out of his chair and be like, that's fantastic, oh my god, I wasn't expecting that.
Oh,
he loves
wow.
Kind of the unexpected, where I think a lot of directors are really just trying to, you know, to mold exactly the moments that they want. David's kind of looking for the ones that aren't on the page or, you know,
I love that. And I love that this film had an unexpected start because it started out as a pilot for a TV show. Was it a challenge in the way that it was shot, shooting first for the pilot and then finishing it as a feature film?
It was a challenge. I think, you know, I mean, I can only, you know, I mean, I know what we were shooting when we were shooting the pilot, you know, and there'd be times where, you know, he'd be shooting you and he'd just be yelling from off camera, like, look into the distance and look into the, looking around. Like, he'd just be directing you on the fly. And I'm sure ABC was getting those dailies and going, what the hell are we making? So they didn't pick us up, needless to say. And I've heard from other sources that, you know, a lot of the execs at the time were kind of like, you know, we were kind of like a running joke, you know, like, oh, look at, you see the weird dailies that David, you know, and then it went dormant, you know, we didn't get picked up, and David, I think, was really disappointed, and I think he had kind of sworn off television, was like, forget it, I think we can't do it with these people.
Yeah.
And then the French, I think it was Canal Plus, stepped in and was like, whatever happened to that? And David was like, well, you know, and David, to his credit, kind of for a couple of years was like, I don't see it as a movie. I see it as this continuing story. And if it ever, you know, strikes me as a movie, I'll write it down. And if I can figure out how to do that. And then we all got the call one day, like, to come back and do reshoots. And it was years later, a couple of years later. And we went back and I think did about a week of additional photography. And then he went into the lab and mixed it and out came Mulholland Drive.
Well, it's amazing because when you watch this finished film, you would never have any idea if you didn't already know that it was based on what started out as a TV pilot, because it is so layered and there's so much symbolism and subtext and surrealism and the way that people have just read so far into it. But because you were making the movie under, well, the show and then the film under those circumstances, what were the challenges in really going day to day and then taking a break and coming back and finishing up a film that you might not have really even understood by that point?
I mean, the challenges were really his, you know, I mean, because, you know, he's, you know, definitely an auteur director. So he's not, you know, in a weird way, as an actor, you kind of just want to service whatever his vision is. You know, I can tell you that when I saw the film, it struck me as so different to what I ever thought it would be or could imagine it would be. You know, because his sets are very light. You know, they're not, you know, these dark, you know, there's no sound effects on the set, so you don't have these dark, brooding undertones and drums. And, you know, he's really good at building an environment on screen. And when we were doing the shoot, you know, he keeps things so light and fun and funny. So it's almost like you're making a romantic comedy or something, you know. and so that when you see the film, you're so taken aback. You know, you kind of remember he screened it for me and Naomi, one of the first people he screened it for, and we sort of stumbled out of his house going like, "Oh my God, incredible! So different than what we thought we had made," you know.
Yeah, well, this has the breakout performance for Naomi Watts. Of course, I knew her from her work back in Australia, but this really launched her.
This was like, and when we left that screening, I remember thinking, oh, my God, her life is going to change. Like,
yeah.
You know, she was so good in that film.
Yeah, what was it like to work with her on this movie? She had a pretty tough job.
She, you know, I mean, all the stuff that I think was the hardest, you know, she had a couple fantastic, I mean, several just mind-blowing scenes in that film, which I wasn't even there for. I was off doing, you know, my scenes. That was the other fun part of it. You know, is obviously he went off and, you know, I mean, there were, you know, weird old people coming out of a paper bag.
Yeah.
I had no idea that got shot, you know. But you know, working with Naomi is fantastic. She's a wonderful, wonderful actress.
Yay.
Well, when you were watching that screening with Naomi for the first time, what was your original interpretation of the movie, and how do you think your interpretation of it changed over the years, maybe if you saw it a couple more times?
I haven't seen it in a long time, actually. I'd like to, maybe I should sit down and see it. It's an omnidirectional movie, sort of, you know, it's, you know, plot-wise, I guess. You know, you can latch on to any number of the characters or the symbolism and start running in different directions with it. But I'll tell you this, when we were doing press for it. We went to the Cannes Film Festival, and it was. I remember David would get angry if we would start to try and decipher it for the people. And I kind of love him for that because he really, you know, I still think to this day he doesn't even do chapter headings and DVDs. He doesn't director's commentary. He really wants people to have as pure an experience watching the film as possible. So whenever you would try and describe it, he'd be like, no, you're going to ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it. You know, if it were up to him, I don't think he would even do trailers or advertisements for his films. You know, he wants people to walk in, he wants the lights to dim, and then he wants them to sort of go on this journey. I've often compared it to like John Coltrane or jazz. You know, it's like, it's a lot different than listening to pop music, you know, where you're waiting for the hook and you're waiting for the bridge and you're just kind of on a little journey, you know. And that's what makes some of those more eclectic art forms more interesting, and that they sort of allow you to have your own experience and relationship with it.
Well, it's so interesting to rewatch. It definitely means something different to me now that I live in LA before I moved over here. And it has such a legacy. It's been 14 years, but does people still come up to you and talk to you about this film?
Occasionally I'll get someone who wants, you know, just goes, what the hell? And sort of broken down for them. But I usually just shrug and go, well, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, your guess is no better or worse than my guess.
Yeah.
Well, what is it about, you know, when you, David Lynch, you know, you work with him for a couple of years making Mulholland Drive, and then you work with him again 5 years later on another Hollywood story, a very dark one called Inland Empire. Had he changed over those 5 years, or was he still the same? Did he still have the same technique with direction and with the actors?
That was a really incredible film to make because that was made over the course of, I think, a couple years or something.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it came out of a monologue. He had a monologue that he wanted Laura Dern to do, and he just was like, let's just shoot this monologue, and just as like a let's get together and have some fun. And he shot this incredible monologue that he wrote that she performed, and it's one take. I think it's in the film, and it's just this incredibly long, complex, convoluted thing, which she just completely murders. She's so good in it. And then I think he built the film off of that monologue. And the other thing that he was doing, which was interesting, was he was doing it, I forget the name of the camera, it was a little, he wanted, you know, he had always sworn off digital, like, oh, you can't do it, and, you know, digital, and he loves film. But in this one, he got sick, I think, of being hamstrung by the budgets that film requires. So he's like, let's just do an experimental movie, you know, that's just shot literally on a handheld, like one of those little things, you know, you just see what people, when they're on vacation, all.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And we made the whole film on that, and then he took it and sort of up-resed it and down-resed it and tried to get it looking as good as possible. But it enabled him to shoot, you know, just copious amounts of footage and made him more facile. And he really, I think, loved that experience, you know.
Well,
he was able to...
We love this experience of talking with you about the making of these movies. I mean, David Lynch, I mean, he really is in a class all by himself.
Yeah.
And
really
just,
is.
You
know, thank you so much, Justin, for taking the time to talk to us here on Profiles, David
thank
Lynch.
You.
Have a great
Pleasure.
Day, and we'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, you bet.
Thanks.
Bye.
Yes! Look, double high five on that one.
Double high five.
Two layers of us.
Yes.
There's us a couple of times high-fiving because we recorded that just before the show, but luckily we did record that because in the meantime we're able to confirm another guest who's coming up really shortly.
In but 8 minutes.
But first, let's get into our Fast Five number
coming
two.
Coming in at number two is...
Wait for it.
You are sick.
Eraserhead.
Oh, Eraserhead. Wow. Okay. Released March 19th, 1977.
Yes.
Dark. Disturbing. Twisted, gross, the stuff that beautiful nightmares are made of. And this is his first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, while I love his films, this is his purest work of art.
Yeah, this is the most surreal of his movies.
Yep.
It does feel like an art piece rather than a traditional movie. It took 5 years for him to make this. He produced it with the help of the AFI, where he was studying at the time, and so much went wrong. He ran out of money. For a while, he had to live on campus at AFI. He had to live in the bedroom where this movie was shot. His high school classmate, Jack Fisk, and wife, Sissy Spacek, gave some money. He changed cinematographers. He couldn't afford to pay his crew, so he said he would give them a piece of the profits, and that worked out really well.
Well, it sure did.
Like, over time.
But this movie, it's like the ultimate independent film. It's the ultimate midnight movie.
Uh-huh.
It's the ultimate cult classic.
The ultimate bizarre film.
It inspired a hairstyle that was modeled after David Lynch's own hairstyle.
Yes.
And this is a film that... Is there's so much that could be said about the film. Again, yep. More subtext, more symbolism.
How would you describe the plot?
Harry
Spencer, a print factory worker on vacation.
Keep going.
Who is looking after a baby creation with his girlfriend.
What kind of baby is that?
Is it an actual baby? Does it represent
something
anxiety?
Else of fatherhood?
Of fatherhood?
That's what I think.
Yeah.
I think that this movie is symbolic of the anxiety of fatherhood. It is symbolic of the consequences of sex, of pregnancy.
Yeah.
If you want to have a baby or you don't want to have a baby, watch this movie.
Yeah. Definitely puts you off. But then there is the guy and the man up there, and then there's the woman.
There's the woman in the radiator, the lady in the radiator singing about the heaven. Everything is fine in heaven.
It's so lovely.
This is a movie. It's a meditation of responsibility, love, loss, and death. That's the simplest way to describe all 89 beautiful minutes of Eraserhead. This is Jack Nance, who's been asked this movie numerous times up until the point that he died, and he finally responded saying, "You guys get way too deep over stuff like this. I don't take it all that seriously. It's only a movie." And Eraserhead is not only a movie.
Definitely a strange movie. And at the time, David Lynch was a new father, so it does have that anxieties of being a parent. His daughter Jennifer needed surgery to correct club feet. And also, as you mentioned before, inspired by his time living in Philadelphia, which he didn't have such a good time doing.
Just full disclosure. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia.
West Philadelphia, born and raised?
Well, Northeast Philadelphia, born and raised, but it's close enough.
Not like
and
Fresh Prince.
Philadelphia! Oh, there you go.
Sorry.
This movie, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, yeah, back in the day in the 70s and early 80s, not the greatest place in the world. Of course, now it's like Disneyland, like Times Square, but I could see where he like picked the wrong place to live while he was like making this movie. But this is a film that had more people had comments to say about Eraserhead than any other film on our Facebook page, which is Profiles with Malone and Mance. Please check that out and give us a like. Maxance Vincent. Maxance is awesome. We love Maxance. Said Eraserhead is a surreal experience. When I watch it, my mouth was shut for the entire time and for the next 2 days. Couldn't express in words what I witnessed, and I still can't now. We agree. It's a weird film, but a damn good one.
I know. I had someone tweet me going, what did I just see? I watched it in preparation, but what did I watch? Aaron Turner says, Eraserhead is one of those films that people try to describe but cannot do it justice, as you just heard. A film you must see for yourself to get the full experience. It feels like a cinematic nightmare because things happen that don't make sense. Things happen that you can't understand. But it's another film that the more you watch, the more you get from it. And another Lynch movie that shows the dark underbelly under what could be a beautiful experience of being a parent. And it's amazing to me that this feels like a cohesive film because it was shot in bits and pieces all over the place.
You would never know that it took 5 years to make. You would swear it took like maybe like a month, if that.
Yeah.
Now, I remember when we were trying to place all the Lynch movies in our Fast Five.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you think? And you shot me back with your listing. You put Eraserhead at number 2, Mulholland Drive at number 3. I was going to shoot you back and say, you mind if we switch places and have Mulholland Drive be number 2 and Eraserhead number 3? But I'm like, you know what? No, this is perfect.
Because it's the most David Lynchian film of all.
It's his most Lynchian film.
And his first film, his first feature film.
Well, it's going from Eraserhead to The Elephant Man, both movies shot in black and white. And watching Eraserhead and then watching Elephant Man, the beginning of Elephant Man with the dream and the elephant, I went, oh, here we go again. But then that movie actually turns out to be much more accessible mm-hmm. by David Lynch standards, because really, to call the Elephant Man an accessible film
is still
a bold statement coming from someone who's just such a visionary like David Lynch.
Well, before we get into our guest, I just want to mention our brackets that happened on our Facebook page.
Yep.
And thanks to Steve Zissou, a.k.a. Justin Bass, or the other way around.
What's
you know
up,
what I mean?
Steve?
Justin, a.k.a. Steve Zissou, who sent me these ones. So this week on our Facebook page, they pitted Lynch's films against each other. So it came down to the final four, which is Mulholland Drive versus Eraserhead and Elephant Man versus Blue Velvet. So out of those two, Mulholland Drive and Elephant Man went ahead.
Ooh.
So then it was Elephant Man versus Mulholland Drive. Which do you think won out of those two?
I'm going with Mulholland.
No, Elephant
no!
Man, but one vote.
One vote.
So it was very equal.
That's
a lot of love for both of those films.
That's excellent. I love, well, again.
And meanwhile, Liam Legrand is on our YouTube, our live chat, and people are telling him that you said that he was sensitive. But we meant that in a good way.
Yeah,
it means
sensitive.
You have a soul. And
you have a soul. You're in touch with
you
your
cry.
Feelings. I mean, that is a very
like
good
I
thing.
Did.
I mean, look, if you're a Beatles fan, you got to be sensitive. That's the bottom line. So take
yeah.
it as a compliment. I'm a sensitive guy. I cry at movies. You don't cry at movies.
No, not very often. But The Elephant Man did get me this time. Oh, we've got our special guest
we've
on the line.
We've got a special guest on the line right now. Just in time for us to talk about our number one David Lynch movie. We have joining us right now. We are so excited to have Kyle MacLachlan on the phone with us right now. Kyle, thank you so much for calling in the Profiles on David Lynch. You are on with Alicia and Scott.
Thank you very much, Scott, Alicia. Nice to be with you.
Oh, we're so excited to talk to you, especially about David Lynch. Your first movie was also your first David Lynch movie. Can you tell us about meeting David Lynch for the first time and what you thought of Dune? Because is it right you were a fan of the book?
I was a huge fan of the book ever since I was about 15 years old. And the whole process that actually got me to the point of meeting David and being considered for the role was very strange, very out of the ordinary. But my first meeting with David, I can certainly remember very vividly, was on the lot at Universal. And he was driving an old Packard Hawk. And he drove in, and I kind of watched him drive by, and I was very excited to meet David Lynch. And he came in and completely disarmed me, because he was just very kind of friendly and easygoing. And turns out he was from the same part of the country as where I grew up, Washington State and Idaho, and I knew it, and we just kind of hit it off immediately, and I just felt very comfortable. So it was kind of a you know, good friends at first sight type of deal, I guess.
Well, what were some of the things that you picked up on his technique, of his style, of the way that he worked with actors?
Well, you know, he makes his actors feel very comfortable, very at ease in front of the camera. He certainly made me feel that way when he directed me for my first ever screen test, which was for Dune, which is an extraordinary way to come into the whole deal.
Yeah.
And he really put me at ease. I mean, I had never been in front of a camera before. I'd been trained in the theater, but not that kind of acting, you know. So he just said that this is what you do, and he would give me just some visuals to think about. Like, he would sometimes talk about Elvis.
Cool.
and sometimes he would talk about a wind coming through, and so he allowed me to interpret those images in my own way, and you know, somehow it worked.
Yeah, I love the way his mind works. And 2 years later, you made my favorite David Lynch film, which is Blue Velvet.
Blue Velvet.
So what was your first take on that screenplay?
I was kind of, it was a mixture of things. It was complete absorption for
mm-hmm.
me, and just overwhelmed at the story and how interesting it was, and the twists and the turns and the unexpected quality. It was quite graphic,
yeah.
In the writing, and that also sort of was a little frightening, you know.
Yes.
I hadn't kind of done anything like that before. But ultimately, I think you have to know David, because people who read it were like, oh my gosh, this is very, you know, explicit, you know, and there was some concern. And I said, yeah, but it's David, and I know David, and I trust David, and I think it's going to be okay. So I really went into it with a sense of it's going to be okay, because I believe in what David is going to do with it.
Well, going from a big budget film like Dune to something more modest like Blue Velvet, did you get the impression that David was actually like, okay, this is the kind of movie I've always wanted to make. This is really where I can flex my muscles and really do something that's going to be my vision.
Well, I think, I mean, Dune was certainly his vision as far as it could be with the, you know, the scope and the scale of that film. I would say, you know, I don't mean to speak for David, but he seemed more comfortable, I guess, working on Blue Velvet. It was a story that he had written. In fact, he had given me the script while we were filming Dune.
Oh, wow.
To look at the role of Jeffrey Beaumont. And I think it was something that perhaps after the monumental scale of Dune probably felt, yeah, a little more comfortable to him, a little more, I don't know, he could sort of wrap his you know, head around it a little bit. It wasn't going to require from him the kind of, I don't know, just the day-to-day grind, I think, that ultimately the Dune became for him, you know, in the filming. So, and it was just exciting, again, to work in that scale. For me, that was my second movie ever, and my second movie to David. So I had nothing to relate it to, but it sure felt like a more comfortable place, I guess.
Well, how was it shooting the scenes with Isabella Rossellini and Dennis Hopper?
Wow.
Who was terrifying in that role.
Dennis was so good. I mean, and again, I was really just green, so new. But I really appreciated what Dennis was doing. And I actually have seen the film recently. I haven't seen the film in years and years, and I watched it at a screening and was just blown away really by everyone's performance.
Yeah.
You know, Dennis and Isabella and Laura, just how well it stands up, and just what Hopper was able to do with that. And he was the nicest guy, you know. He was just so easygoing, you know, except in the scenes that we were working on, he was terrifying, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't carry the Frank Booth character around with him when we cut. You know, he was laughing and having a great time. We actually all remarked that we had such a wonderful time. You know, there were a couple days that were very, very intense and challenging and difficult and emotionally very, very draining, you know. But by and large, we really just enjoyed the process. We enjoyed the work with David, with each other. We enjoyed creating some really unusual scenes, which you could recognize as unusual when you were filming them. Weren't sure, you know, because you always kind of put your, well, I wonder how the audience is going to react to this. Well,
yeah.
We're going to see. So there was some of that going on. But overall, we got along all great, you know.
Well, transitioning from film to TV for the landmark, the phenomenon that became Twin Peaks, what was it like shifting gears?
Yeah.
From meetings like that, did you feel that David was still able to just pursue and move ahead the way he had moved forward in his movies, or did he have more to play around with because, well, hey, now I can develop these characters for episodic television?
Yeah, you know, I think it was that developed gradually, you know, because he had written this pilot, Backdoor Pilot, which was 2 hours, which could also be converted into a movie of the week if necessary. You know, if the pilot didn't get picked up, then at least they had, you know, this property that they could sell and make it broadcast. So it started off as being called Northwest Passage, changed to Twin Peaks. He and Mark Frost gotten together and written this. Again, it was, he came to me and said, look at this role of Cooper. And I had done not too much, you know, I mean, then Blue Velvet, I did a little movie called The Hidden, and I'd worked on The Doors, so I was still just kind of finding my way, and I was finding that the film world was difficult. You know, I didn't really fit into any kind of category, and so I was having some difficulty just trying to, you know, make a career. And then this came along, and just was like, well, this is so amazing. Of course, I'm going to do this. The character was just on, you know, everything that makes Cooper so great was on the page, and I just had to follow the blueprint. And so it was with great excitement that I joined. None of us on the cast anticipated that it would go further than just the pilot.
Wow.
So of course you're sitting there and you're signing 5.5 years or 6 years, I think then is what it was, on this very thick contract. And we're all kind of laughing like, well, they're going to burn this because of course it's just going to be a one-time deal, you know, and who would be in their right mind would ever, you know, put this on the air for more than one. But lo and behold, you know, ABC went forward with it and we created this spectacular series, a short-lived series that has had such great resonance, you know, over the years. So
yeah.
Very exciting.
That's for sure.
And now you're reprising your role once again as Agent Cooper. Are you excited about season 3?
Oh, yes. You mean, yeah, coming back again?
Yes.
Very excited. You know, it's... you know, as we've been hearing and everything is still, there's still things to be worked out. But I'm holding a very good thought.
Oh, cool.
that we are going to return to Twin Peaks.
Yes, I hope so.
That is amazing that, what, more than 20 years after the fact, to reprise the role. And by the way, you look exactly the same.
Well, you're very kind. You're very kind. Smoke and mirrors, I'm afraid.
Smoke and mirrors, that's Hollywood.
You know, it's all, no, believe me, I don't. But thank you.
Well, listen, Kyle, thank you so much for calling in the Profiles. I got to tell you, talking about David Lynch, I mean, he's a filmmaker like no other, and to have you call in and to talk with us and talk to our fans, such a treat. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, well, I'm so glad that you thought of me, and I really appreciate that, and it's been a pleasure. He's a great friend, obviously a great filmmaker, and I can't say enough about him, so it's nice to be able to talk about him with you.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great, great day. We'll see you soon.
Cheers. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
So cool.
That was cool.
Oh, he's so nice.
Wow.
He's such a nice guy.
Justin and Kyle.
I know.
Like, that is so great. How great is that? They're like, he's a nice guy. He's like a really nice guy.
You're
watching his movies and you're like, this guy's got to be like off his rocker.
Yeah.
And you hear how like nice he is.
Exactly. I love hearing how nice he is and how much fun everyone seemed to have on the sets. Like even Dennis Hopper as the really scary villain was a nice guy to hang out with. And it's such a great thing to think of because it doesn't seem that way in the film.
And what talent to be able to just flick it on like a light switch and go, mommy, mommy, daddy, baby, all that, and start with this, and then just have it be cut and like, and just be a nice guy and just be like, hey, we're having fun making a movie.
Well, I think so, people can guess what our Fast Five number one
is.
Oh, mommy, mommy.
Ooh, Blue Velvet. September 19th, 1986. Cost $6 million to make. Box office almost $9 million. Again, just like Mulholland Drive, movie was nominated for one Academy Award for Best Director for David Lynch. And like Mulholland Drive and just like Eraserhead and just like so many of his films, Blue Velvet is a masterpiece.
It sure is, and it's a film I grow to love more and more as I watch it again and again and again. The screenplay had done the rounds during the 70s and the early 80s, but no studio wanted to touch it because of its explicit content and the fact that it is so dark and disturbing. Basically, here we go again. It's about a guy who
finds an ear.
Finds a severed ear in a field, and that takes him and another girl down, and Sandy, down on this mystery, played by Laura Dent, on this mystery, which exposes the dark underbelly behind this beautiful suburbia.
Just like Naomi Watts did in Mulholland Drive.
So again, it is a neo-noir, like a modern film noir. It does... got so excited. It does feel like it's set in the 50s, but it's not, and... yeah, Dennis Hopper is one of the most remarkable performances and the scariest villains on screen. Mommy, the gas.
Oh, the gas. What was that gas?
Terrified me. Well, apparently David Lynch told Dennis Hopper to imagine it was like amyl nitrate.
Oh, I see.
Because apparently originally they wanted it to be helium.
Oh, but then like Grace's voice?
Yeah, but then Dennis Hopper said he would sound ridiculous when he said, mommy, like in a high-pitched voice.
But it kind of would fit. Which would have gotten away with that? But some interesting symbolism. Like the movie starts off in this beautiful small town, and then it cuts down to below the grass, and you see all the insects. Mm-hmm. And this is like... symbolic of the fact that beneath this beautiful town, there is a really, really dark underbelly. And as for why he chose an ear, because the ear has a hole that leads into the mind. And in the beginning of the film, the camera zooms into the ear, and that's where the story unfolds. And at the end of the film, the camera pulls back out of the ear, and everything is just hunky-dory again.
It's so interesting. David Lynch said, firstly, he came up with the idea for the title. He liked the title Blue Velvet. Secondly, he came up with the idea of the image of the severed ear and insects coming out of it.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, he came up with the idea of the song because he really enjoyed that song and thought that it fit. It evoked a time and a mood. And when coupled with this story, it's quite unnerving.
Well, even the critics at the time liked it. The New York Times' Janet Maslin said, "This is an instant cult classic, as fascinating as it is freakish." Sheila Benson in the LA Times said, "This film is shocking, visionary, and rapturously controlled."
I remember it caused a lot of controversy at the time because it's sadistic and it's about voyeurism and an Oedipus complex and bondage, and the Dennis Hopper is sociopathic, and Siskel and Ebert, they very much disagree with each other.
Oh, they did?
On this one, yeah. So Siskel loved it. Ooh. Ebert hated it.
And
you can see online, you can see their review, and they are at opposite ends of the scale.
They're going off on it.
Yes, I love it so much.
It's a good thing we love it.
And this has all the trademark Lynchian stuff in there, like beautiful cinematography and distorted characters and very, very surreal moments.
Yes, it really is David Lynch at his very best. A couple other films that we wanted to mention before we run out of time is
good
David Lynch movies.
Hit me with it.
I love The Straight Story, 1999. Yep. Just like Elephant Man, it's a very straightforward story. It's rated G. Just to give you an idea of just how family-friendly this movie is.
Wow.
Touching and heartwarming, poignant. Richard Farnsworth was nominated for an Oscar. He was, at the time, the oldest best actor to be nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah.
Also, the movie Wild at Heart from 1990. Ooh,
won the Palme d'Or in Cannes. It's a bizarre, violent, also love story.
Also,
another
crazy character played by Willem Dafoe.
Yes, and then also has Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern.
Laura Dern is fantastic in this movie. But let's go count down our Fast Five.
Yes.
Coming in at number five is Lost Highway. Number four,
The Elephant Man.
Number three, Mulholland Drive. Number two, Eraserhead. Number one, Blue Velvet. One more time, make sure you go to our Facebook page, Profiles with Malone and Mance. Like us, join in on the fun. Tell us what you love about these movies, what you love about Profiles. Go to iTunes, subscribe to Profiles, rate and review us on iTunes. Share Profiles with all of your friends.
Yeah, subscribe to youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork. I don't know who we're going to do next.
Well, in order for us to figure that out, we are going to figure that out, and we will announce who our next profile will be on our Facebook page.
Keep the suggestions coming, because I love hearing the suggestions.
We love when people tweet us at Alicia Malone or at Movie Mance. Again, that's at Alicia Malone, at Movie Mance. Give us your ideas. Tell us what you thought of Profiles today. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We'll be back very soon, and until next time,
please watch some David Lynch movies.
Bye! Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.